father.
He killed me. He killed me the day he refused to pay my ransom.
Was this all about the oil?
It is my oil. Mine. And my family's. It runs in my veins, thicker than blood. I'm going to redraw the map. And when I'm through, the whole world will know my name, my grandfather's name, the glory of my people.
No one will believe this meltdown was an accident.
Ha! They will believe. They will all believe. You understand? Nobody can resist me.
Do you expect me to talk?
Golden singing there.
Hello, and that was Chris singing the amazing titles to The World Is Not Enough.
You know, I'm kind of surprised I never did a Tina Turner for GoldenEye. I'm surprised that never happened.
You didn't want to show her up. She's rock and roll royalty.
Yeah. Well,
why would you want to embarrass her? by showing the world there was a better version that could have been done.
Anyway, if you're just tuning in, this is episode 28 of
If You're Just
Use
Tuning
Me to
In.
Talk.
If you're just tuning in, it's because you probably listen to podcasts front to back. So you would just be tuning in at this point, I would hope.
Anyway, this week we are talking about Pierce Brosnan Pain Face Aplenty, as we discussed. It's Pain Face Aplenty.
Oh, that reminds me of another tweet I put up today with Love Becker on it. But anyway, carry on.
Longest intro ever. This is taking me forever to introduce this film. Bloody hell. Anyway, yes, it's time to discuss The World Is Not Enough, starring Pierce Brosnan, Sophie Marceau, Denise Richards, Robert Carlyle, John Cleese, Goldie, and Robbie Coltrane. It was scripted by Neil Purvis, Robert Wade, Bruce Feinstein, David Arnold doing the score again, directed by Michael Apted, released 1999.
It's not Tom Arnold, is it, no?
No, not Tom Arnold. It's not, no. Good
just
old David.
It. Just check it.
It's a lesser-known brother David. Yeah, what
and
do you
Arnold,
to the,
Arnold Schwarzenegger scoring.
Yeah, Arnold. Yeah, this is the pre-Millennium Bond. What do you guys reckon to it, then?
Chris, away you go, buddy.
Okay, well, admittedly, this is actually my favourite Pierce Brosnan Bond film.
What?
Yeah, it's not... I wouldn't necessarily think it's the greatest. I think it's just my personal favourite, and I think the main reason is, well, there's two reasons are. One, I think it's probably the best performance that Brosnan does as Bond, Pain Face included. but I think, you know, like we've all kind of said, I think as we've recorded podcasts throughout the show, is this has like DNA of a great Bond film. It just doesn't. I think it lost its nerve, and I think for various different reasons, possibly not the right director for it, maybe not the right casting for a certain someone, Denise Richards. but I think you look at it, you think, okay, it has great moments in it, and it could have been so much better. It could have been essentially been Brosnan's Majesty's. It's that. Could have been, and for that I kind of I look it from that angle, but
it has greatness in its DNA, but it didn't quite reach its full potential for you.
Essentially, yeah. But you know, as a film itself, I again, like last week, I think it's perfectly watchable. I don't get bored by it. I just, you know, it's it does its job. I just wish it could have been better, but the things I like about it, I really do like. So Dave.
Very, very. I mean, I said this about Tomorrow Never Dies last week, but I think this is a very, very difficult film for me to rank. I did say I'd give a little bit of history, not a lot. It's just simply that this is probably about 5 years after I found On Her Majesty's Secret Service, and it was pre coming to appreciate Timothy Dalton. So at this point, I really probably hadn't thought there was a great Bond film since Majesty's, and because that had already very quickly become my favourite, that's the Bond film I want every time out. I always remember Michael G. Wilson said that every time we set out to make a Bond film, we want to make From Russia With Love, and we end up making Thunderball. And you could, you know, talk about that for a long time. But the gist is people often have like an ideal Bond film in their head. And mine being Majesty's, really, really warm to this. There's been three times in the series. At this point, it was only the second time, because the third is Casino Royale, that I've genuinely believed Bond has fallen in love. I do buy it in this story. I agree with Chris. I think this is actually comfortably Brosnan's best performance in the role, with the exception of one moment and one scene.
I know which scene you're alluding to.
There's one scene I think he's dreadful in, and there's one moment where I think he's just like read his dialogue off a comic book. But we'll get to it. But apart from that, he's... You know, along with last week, this is his sort of golden period in terms of how he looks in the role. He's completely relaxed. Sophie Marceau is outstanding. I think I very much like the production design and look of the film, more in terms of sets and suits and everything else than locations. And it is set up and ready to be a great Bond film, even though I can still nitpick a lot of the first hour. There's still a lot of problems with it and a lot of things that don't make sense. But it's got a very memorable pre-title. It's got a great performance. It's got a great... Well, she turns out to be the lead villain, but it's got a great leading lady, if you count Sophie Marceau that way. And it's as good as Pierce Brosnan ever gets. So whilst I don't love it like I used to, the Majesty's fan in me overrated this film for years, and I still like it a great deal.
I think for me, I would have to agree with a lot of what you said, really. But the only thing that stops me from saying, oh, this is Brosnan's like greatest Bond film, is I think to do with pacing and editing. There's probably a good 40 minutes that could be chopped out easily, and you wouldn't miss anything of the story. But apart from that, I think Brosnan's looked the best, as he does all series. Apart from GoldenEye, which I love, but this is probably like maybe I ranked them the other way last week, but I'm having to kind of do a bit of backtracking and probably put this like second best performance for sure. So, okay. Yeah, it looks great. So.
It is very difficult, though, because...
For me, it chops and changes all the time. I mean, like, GoldenEye will be number one. Diamond will always be number four.
You tend to chop and change. But even allowing for the fact you chop and change, Becca, this is a difficult film to rank, just because you can be very let down by its sort of second hour and a bit. Or you can do what Chris and I sort of do sometimes, and see the potential within it and the elements of great Bond films you like, and rate it perhaps higher than its end result deserves. This film could go anywhere from just sneaking into the top 10 to like flat bottom, depending on your mood, definitely. Once upon a time, it would have been top 5 to me. It isn't now. It's nowhere near. But it's still, on a good day, it's my favourite Brosnan. On a good day.
Yeah,
I think that's down to... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to just sort of like reiterate what Dave just said. I think it's mainly because I think you look at Tomorrow Never Dies, it's more cohesive. It's a lot more, like, it knows what it is and it stays there. This one is a little bit messy, a little bit all over the place. It's like the good bits are really good, but it's let down by kind of just like middling to kind of poor other elements. And it's just kind of like, it depends on your mood. So you got like... something really, really good, and then some things are just kind of disappointing, to something that's kind of like, yeah, pretty good, and is consistently pretty good, or at least pretty entertaining, you know? Mm. So that's the way, it probably depends on your mood, depends on your outlook of what you want from a Bond film, in terms of ranking the middle two Brosnans, but I agree that it's difficult to kind of rank this one. I mean, if it was me personally, I would rank this higher, but I think
Tomorrow Never Dies is a consistent experience, not just through the film but from viewing to viewing. And I think with this film I've gone all over the map, from loving it to kind of resenting it. And I go all over the map with this film. And it's the only Brosnan one I really do. I think I'm quite consistent on thinking GoldenEye's good but overrated. Tomorrow Never Dies is paint by numbers but quite entertaining. And Die Another Day I've always thought is poor. So yeah, this is his most erratic work, but he's really good in this for the most part.
Brosnan is fantastic in this. I think this is his best performance all around. But I think I'm not blaming Michael Apted for anything, but I'm not saying it was all his fault, blah blah blah. But I was just sort of thinking it's very similar into how he said that Spy Who Loved Me, for example, is a film of two halves. Mm. The World Is Not Enough is quite similar. Like, it doesn't know if it wants to be. Obviously, it's very character driven. Whereas Tomorrow Never Dies was pretty much a shoot 'em up. It was like Die Hard, kind of like 90s blockbuster shoot 'em up. But with this one, you've got a lot more character study and kind of Bond's more involved with Elektra. And you've got M involved as well out in the field too. So you've got those kind of issues going on. But yeah, it doesn't know if it wants to be a character study or another kind of late 90s action flick. But I do think Apted is a lot to do with it. So but I really enjoyed it. It's the last 20 minutes kind of really drags a little bit for me. But on the whole, great bit of Bond, I think.
Yeah, I think Michael Apted is just kind of like the wrong choice, and it's hard to really tell because we have had directors with no previous like action film experience come on to do great films, and because they built up the drama instead, and it's like the production side to handle all the set pieces, and it works out fine. Sam Mendes. I mean, even though I have issues with Skyfall, the way he does the action isn't the issue I have, and aspect of that,
Plus, we never really know how. I mean, when we talked about John Glenn, what we ended up having to say was, well, the films are on his watch, so we'll give him the credit for the action, but we don't actually know how much of it is second unit.
No, we don't know.
Obviously, their name's over the door and they have to sign off on it, but Mark Forster isn't necessarily good or bad at action on the basis that basically the Bourne team did the second unit on Quantum. So I don't really know. I'm going to hedge my bets a little bit more on Michael Apted, and perhaps we'll talk about it as we get to different scenes. I actually think he's the right kind of director for this kind of Bond film, but we don't know what was going on behind the scenes. We don't know how involved with the script he was, how involved with the action he was, and how much of a stretch a 2-year gap to the previous film was at this stage in sort of film history.
To me, it kind of just felt like it was just kind of there to kind of do what the producers wanted him to do. So it just felt very much like there's just a paid gig, really, rather than like a passion project. It's funny, with watching this now, the first time I thought, wouldn't it be great if Mark Campbell did it? or someone like that who had a bit more panache with the action.
That would be brilliant.
You can kind of like, I think that's what this film needed, particularly when it comes to the action, is just something with a bit more. I mean, it's not like they're particularly bad, it's just they're just like, they're okay, they're just kind of paint by numbers. They just, it just would have liked.
GoldenEye, we said it was dated, but it's got the most distinctive visual style of his first three. Dying of the Day's got a very distinctive style for the wrong reasons. And Casino Royale was beautiful. So I have to draw from that Martin Campbell has a particular affinity for Bond films because he's had two cracks at it and got it largely right. And one of those, and arguably both, I may not agree on GoldenEye, but arguably both, for a lot of people, would be top five Bond films. I would love Martin Campbell to have done this. And the one thing he didn't prove with GoldenEye, but did prove with Casino Royale, is that he can handle a love story as well.
Yeah. Definitely. I know. I think he knows how to handle drama to enough extent, as long as the story's there.
Yeah, definitely. That's where I agree. He handles it really well because you've got the characterization and sort of more deepening relationship between Bond and Elektra. Definitely, I think that's where he handles well, but falls down so much on the action side of things.
But I do think that.
Sorry to interrupt you, Chris.
You can argue about Michael Apted, that person.
What I'm saying it's not his fault, is what I'm saying.
But I think either way, I think the instincts, because he says on the commentary they wanted to sort of slightly recalibrate. What he was clearly saying is they wanted a bit more meaty drama in this one than the last one. And I think the instincts of going that way you might argue about the quality of the filmmakers relative to each other, but it's the same instinct that sends you to a Sam Mendes. And I don't think that's a bad instinct. I don't think Michael Apted is the wrong direction. It's just whether he's the right person.
Yeah.
And I don't think we'll ever really know, because we don't know what he wasn't fully signing off
on. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I think it's more a case of the producers like Brock Buckley and Michael G. Wilson probably at the time were just kind of... I mean, they've just had a good hit with GoldenEye, and they just like, and Tomorrow Never Dies was a good hit, and they want to follow through with the same old. So they hired Michael Apted to, like, okay, well, you're good with drama, so you deal with the drama bits, and then we'll sort out the actiony type stuff. And I think it was just kind of like just thrown together, kind of like.
But I do think on an artistic level, they were possibly a little bit disappointed with Tomorrow Never Dies.
Yeah, I mean, I think Brosnan was particularly... Didn't you say last week that Brosnan said it was particularly, like, difficult on set?
He found it chaotic. He turned... Well, I don't think he... I think Brosnan always had a great time, and unless we could, see an interview with him or even have an interview with him on the subject, we're never going to know. But piecing it together from different things he said, I get the impression he enjoyed all his Bond sets... But Tomorrow Never Dies, of all of them, was the most chaotic, the most rushed, the script in the least developed place.
It wasn't finished.
And then he's got a leading lady in Terry Hatcher he didn't get on with fantastically well. And so I think he was probably, reading between the lines, he was probably, and we can only read between the lines, most disappointed with that film of possibly even the four.
I was reading somewhere that... Pierce Brosnan, the film that he liked the least is Die Another Day.
I've never heard him comment on that. That would stand to reason. He's an intelligent man with some taste, but I think on the Everything or Nothing film, he does laugh at the whole kite surfing tsunami thing. So it's quite clear he thought it had gone a bit ridiculous. But I've never heard that sort of smoking gun phrase of we really jumped the shark at that point, or it had gone too far.
I mean, bear in mind, this is something I've read on the internet today. So it's...
Go for it.
So, yeah, so...
I think we have to admit, we have to admit to any listeners here, we research as best we can, but, you know, our sources may be false. What did you read, Chris?
No, it was basically that he was like, Dying of Day was his least favourite of the films that he may have said in some interview somewhere. It was probably, I probably read it on Wikipedia, quite frankly. but, you know, it's understandable. I think it would make sense because, I mean, I suppose we'll probably talk about it a little bit in more detail next week, but when we come to Dying of Day... this is his last film, and you know, obviously he was a little bit... He wanted to do one more, and I think it's understandable when you've done something that's probably your least favourite, you kind of want to do just another one just to kind of go off on a high. You know, just kind of like, well, let me go on something better.
Michael Apted consistently says on it, and I said this last week, Michael Apted consistently says on his commentary that Brosnan, who he doesn't characterise as pushy in any way, but Brosnan did say often he wanted meaty character work, storylines, scenes, meaning to what he was doing. Now, his favourite Bond film, his first Bond film, was Goldfinger. No one's suggesting he wanted a Majesty's or a latterly a Casino Royale, but he wanted, I can imagine from everything I've heard Brosnan say, whilst I've not heard him say that about Die Another Day, it would stand to reason. And the fact that he was quite enamoured with the idea of doing a 1950s set Casino Royale and everything else, yeah, I think he wanted a tougher version of the character than he ended up with.
And I think it's evidence here as well in the film itself, because you kind of see that, I mean, particularly in the opening scene at the bank, in the Swiss banker,
which might be one of his best scenes in the role, full stop.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I think that is quintessentially the best. I mean, the scene itself is okay. It's not like, you know...
It's one look, but we'll get to it. In fact, let's enjoy this film sequentially.
I feel we should have some theme music when you go sequentially to start, like, you know, like Desert Island Discs or something like that. Yeah, the Bond theme even better.
I will find something cheesy to put there at some point, but possibly not in the Bond series now, maybe later on.
And we're moving on.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, let's go through it scene by scene.
This pre-title, Love It or Hate It, is a real landmark in the series because it's the longest.
14 minutes of boat chase spectacular.
I put a time check on it today. Shirley Manson sings her first word, if you like.
Oh, God, there we go.
At 14 and a half minutes.
Yeah, there we are. Well, so, yeah, I sort of counted it from the end of the gun barrel.
You're about right, though. It's 14 something. Yeah,
14 point something minutes. But anyway, it's the longest in the series. Hopefully it'll win you the Bond round and a pub quiz somewhere. But it's yet to be beaten. So you start off in Bilbao in Spain.
Some of this doesn't eventually ends up not making sense. But Bond is sat at a banker's private office, and the banker is the guy who played Chisholm in Minder all those years ago.
And
Patrick Malahide, I think he's called, and he's there to basically collect some money. We don't know any more than that at this point. And he's trying to get a name on where that money's coming from. He does a Sean Connery impression because he mentions his hidden assets.
Yeah, I saw that. They do a little back and forth, don't they?
He's wearing a pair of specs, and when he takes them off, there's a little gadget on them that explodes the gun that's been taken off him on the table. And there's a real venomous, all-business look in his face when he actually opens fire. And for once, Brosnan, who's quite a slight man, seems quite dangerous.
He looks good in this opening scene. I tell you that now. I remember going to see this at the cinema and was like, he's looking fine. I mean, obviously, I don't know how old he was.
This is a 14-year-old girl perving over a 46-year-old.
He looks good. I mean, Bond's kind of like quite lean, quite aesthetic.
He's in good shape.
Good here, I must say that now. Yep.
Well, yeah, as I said before, I think this is probably his best performance as Bond. I think
I'll probably be more perving when it comes to Daniel Craig later on, but never mind.
Yeah, she's going to undo the damage of this borderline relationship of 32 years age gap by perving over the current James Bond to redeem herself.
I just can't go with the fact that last time we talked about Roger Moore, I wouldn't do Roger Moore. He's happily married.
Yeah, he's 89, Becca. Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah, I rescind my statement.
But yeah,
he looks good in this.
I think his performance. Dave's talked about that look, and yeah, I agree. But I think it, to me, it's in a more subtle way. I think his whole performance in this scene is kind of spot on. He kind of balances between the kind of relaxed, kind of like quippy sort of gestures.
Financial fun.
Yeah, kind of thing. But yeah, still have like, I think when he just asks him for like the name and kind of brushes off, he's like, he just goes, just one name. And it's just kind of, it's very relaxed, very kind of smooth, but you get the sense that there is like, no, don't fuck around with me. You know, I'm not gonna overplay it, but don't fuck around with me. You know, so you do get that sense of like, yeah, he is in control. The banker and
I think that's what I was gonna say. It's that he's relaxed, but he's got this. I think that's
like
how you would summarize
like, kind of business quality, really, isn't it? He's like, he's there. You know, don't screw with me. I just want this information.
Yeah,
sort it.
I mean, it might sound like we're overplaying one scene, but it is such a positive start to a film.
Yeah, it's a really strong start. I like it.
He looks great, and he looks totally settled in the role. And it's been a couple of years since the last one, and like he is totally, totally in control. Love it. I think it's really good.
Yeah, I mean, originally it was just going to be this bit for the opening scene when it was initially written, but obviously.
Let's describe not describe the whole thing, but it was going to end. Because basically he's got Malahide at gunpoint. He is basically gets a knife thrown into the back of his neck, the banker, and it's Cigar Girl who's run for it.
Yeah, they're clearly playing on the whole Bill Clinton, like Monica Lewinsky cigar thing.
We will get to that in a minute because that's a little bit later.
I think they even reference it because he gives her like a little fleeting look when she offers him cigars. Like it's like almost like a very Roger Moore.
She does, but also it's when she's. We'll get to it in a minute because he sees Moneypenny during the scene.
They do but it harder later.
It was supposed to end. He basically, somebody else is about to shoot him who gets sniped through the window. So, and also the Spanish police, we assume, are about to come through the door. Mm-hmm. And he uses a curtain cord, really, isn't it, to jump out of the window.
Yeah, it's like a bungee.
That's where the pre-title did end. And test audiences said that's a bit lame as a pre-title.
Yeah, it's too short.
So they extended it, and so we move on to the next bit where he's back at MI6, and he goes in and gives Moneypenny the cigar, and she says, "I know exactly what to do with that," which is even better. And that's a Lewinsky reference. I'll let listeners who don't remember it look that up because sure you can infer it by the way we're talking about it, but certain behaviours of the last Clinton president in the Oval Office, and not just the Oval Office, and that's what that's a reference to. I actually tend to think this sequence is now. It was exciting and great at the time. I actually think it's too long now. What do you guys think?
I love it. Every single second of it. I just think it's one of the greatest boat chases in Bond history.
I've got no problem with any of the constituent parts, but it goes a hell of a long time to the opening.
I was going to say, the only thing in the sequence is like Moneypenny. So, for example, last time we saw her, in Goldeneye, she was like, well, you know, independent woman. I was out with a gentleman, you know, I don't sit at home pining, waiting for James Bond to come along.
You've never had me.
No, this is it, exactly. Yeah. And then
she's totally retconned for her last two appearances.
Yeah, they had the fake VR liaison in the next film, we'll get there. But yeah, like this thing was like, oh, what did you bring me? An engagement ring? And she's like, I can hear, you know.
I can,
bless her. That's the only bit I don't like about this sequence. But apart
I don't
from that,
like I it either, because it's just jarring. I mean, if Moneypenny had never been changed, then whilst I'm sure there are a lot of detractors who would say this is such an outdated way to portray a modern, intelligent woman, you would at least be able to say, well, that's the character, that's always been the character, and we love the series.
And then you've got a bit of jealousy between her and Dr. Molly Warmflesh later on in the movie, which is a bit...
But the fact that you've had two episodes of Moneypenny slightly reimagined, with still a bit of sort of sparring and tension between them, I was very disappointed by this at the time.
Yeah, this bit jars a little bit, so...
Yeah.
But apparently, it's literally just like 1 minute, if that, on screen, so, you know...
To be fair, she does.
Good.
She does play it well.
She does
play it with like a not like a kind of oh James. She does play it with like the oh, same old she, kind of.
I get why she's definitely. Your favourite, Chris. I really do. I think Samantha Bond is. I mean, the nostalgia in me still leans to Lois Maxwell because I always thought she had such great chemistry with all of her leading men, romantic or otherwise. But I think if you took nostalgia out of it, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree as well, definitely. I think, because obviously, like, Brosnan being my generation's Bond, so, you know, Samantha Bond is my generation's Moneypenny, so, definitely. It's just this, you know, couple of her lines of dialogue that's a bit jarring, but apart from that, great. Yeah.
I mean, well...
Anyway.
I mean, my opinion on the boat chase, it does... I mean, this time...
Let's woe back a minute.
Okay.
Obviously, he goes via Moneypenny to see M, and we need to explain that just for a minute. The money he was getting from that banker was in order to give back to the businessman Sir Robert King, who is a friend of M's back from university days. So he is in M's office, basically because he's gone to MI6 to collect the money, because it seems to be cash, which doesn't make sense, really. Mm. But also, he gets to thank Bond and see his old friend. Mm.
That's the emotional connection there, doesn't it, for later on down the line?
Oh, I think it's entirely valid, but if you can pick away at it. They have a drink, because she's fond of a bit of bourbon, isn't she?
Yeah. important plot, which we do see Bond actually touch the money before he goes in, because it's important to remember, because he notices while he's having the drink, he picks up the ice with his hand. I think it's quite
a chemical reaction.
I think this is one of the things what I like about the... It's one of the elements what I like about the film, is Bond is actually putting things together. It's like, hang on, what? This is odd. What the fuck?
You see him doing detective work, don't
like,
you? You've got to
like,
put pieces
hang on,
together
that's,
yourself.
That's a chemical. Shit, the money. You know, he's put... He's,
yeah.
And it's like, ah, oh, this is quite... I mean, it doesn't make that much sense, really, but...
You see him doing his job pretty much, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's putting two and two
along,
together.
It runs along really well, and you've got to think... I mean, this is pre-9/11, and I really hate talking about 9/11 allegories, but certainly the modern concern of like terrorism hitting us where we live. You know, they're inside one of the most secure buildings in London. So yeah, this was pretty dramatic stuff at the time.
And the then wasn't there something in the news that a very similar attack happened around the same sort of time? I remember reading in the news.
I'd never thought about that since the time, but didn't they have something in the lobby once someone got in the door? I don't know if that was MI6 or MI5. But yeah, they've had attempted attacks. The only thing I guess that doesn't really make sense here, firstly, why is the boat facing towards a hole in the wall up there?
But what I want to know is what does Q want with torpedoes if it's a fishing boat?
Well, we'll get to that because that's post-type. But what is the guard girl doing out there with a laser-pointed gun?
Yeah, exactly. That's the main question.
They've already got the guy they're after.
Well, no, I think that, well, it's not very well thought through. I mean, like, I think the plan is once Bond has done his job in killing King with the money, then the plan was to kill Bond. In a sense, like, just to cut off all ties. Because I remember reading, I think it's in the novel, I think it says a deleted scene where it's before we go to MI6, is like, we see Cigar Girl go to what sniper, when we see that sniper is actually Renard. And he says, like, well, I think a death's in order, thinking that Bond knows too much anyway. So she is there to kind of take out Bond to kind of finish the job. How she would know he would be precisely there is anyone's guess. That's the bit where it's like, hang on, but it's
the sort of thing. I mean, I'm going to show up my like weaknesses here, and that I'm sure there's people listening who were like, yeah, I spotted that at the time. But for me, it was the sort of thing that like it crosses your mind 3 days afterwards. I don't think it bothered me in the moment.
Well, no, because the momentum gets, it's like you get this thing and basically right straight to a chase, because you can't have another, hang on. You know, it'd be difficult. So it's just a lot easier to kind of like have someone there with a smoking gun, in a manner of speaking, to chase, essentially. I think the boat chase is kind of, it goes straight from kind of Connery-esque. I mean, we get the, you know, Bond's actually using his head. He's like, he's seeing the chemical in his hands. He doesn't use a gadget to get out of the building. He uses like,
it's very Craig-like as well. Like no time to think about it.
And then
I've just got to do this.
And then instantly it goes to Roger Moore. He's like, everything.
When they, the first sign of that for me was when they splashed the what are they called? Car park people.
Yeah.
The campers. Yeah, because there was that series campers, in 1999, wasn't there? And people hated them so much.
And it was just awful. And and going through the fish restaurant, and you're thinking, yes, he beeped his horn, but he would have killed people there. And he's steering it along the street and things like that, which wouldn't work. So I agree, and I take your point, and we've given a lot of things passes, and I'm sure I've sat here in previous episodes and gone, well, it doesn't matter because it's really good. But I just think it's another sign that perhaps it's a bit too long.
It's just straight out of Roger Moore. Like, it's straight out of Roger Moore. Everything about it is just like, well, this is like Roger Moore did. This is clearly like...
It's a little bit like in A View to a Kill when you've got the car, isn't it? He's kind of obviously driving the car around Paris and he hasn't got an engine. It's like, what?
But also, when you get to the end of it, I mean, I like the fact it finished at the Millennium Dome, which, as we record, is known as the O2. But obviously, that's time-sensitive naming rights. But it was official. It was originally the Millennium Dome. It wasn't
around that Millennium as well.
It wasn't finished at the time when they filmed this. They had to put a bit of temporary sort of roofing on. But I really kind of like this, and it actually leads to our disappointment with the second half of this film, that, you know, we can protect you, not from him. Are they setting up here? This guy has got to be terrifying, which makes what we get more of a letdown. But overall, I think it's a really, I think it's too long, but I think it's a really good pre-title.
What I like about it, and they don't really utilize it later on in the film, as you say, but I like the fact we start off with Bond injured. Because obviously he, you know, the set of
points. He's got a shoulder injury, hasn't he?
Yeah. It's like he saves himself from the Millennium Dome. But if you put nowadays, like the Craig films, for Bond to be kind of like quotation marks injured, he has to get bloody shot and survive like a 5-story drop, you know.
Well, I would like to just say that, Chris, to any sort of younger listeners here that maybe don't remember this film on first release, because it's easy now that we look at Craig, and whether you like or hate his era, we are used to this guy getting pretty beaten up. It varies from film to film. I mean, we talked about how Inspector, he's having sex moments after getting quite a kicking. But in Casino Royale, he did get tortured in quite a bad time. Yeah. But at the point where this film was released, the idea of Bond carrying an injury through the film was actually really, really fresh.
Yeah, you're not seen it so much before, had we, I don't think.
I don't think we'd ever seen it, had we?
No,
off the top of my head, I couldn't think of one, so I was really impressed by that. We come out of the credits. We'll go on to the credits. We'll come back to the credits in a second. But you come out of the credits, and the first thing you see is his arm in a sling, and he's on the inactive roster.
Still the briefing.
Yeah.
Still the
Yeah, we'll get to that. None of that makes sense. Why is he getting gadgets if they're not his? But anyway,
yeah, that doesn't make sense either.
Why is he there? You're deactive from duty, really? Why the fuck am I even in the briefing?
Badly hurt. And we also get that Daniel Kleinman thing that he does a lot. He does as much with Daniel as well, where, I mean, I loved it. He rolled down the Millennium Dome and then he's hanging and it says Albert R. Broccoli's Eon Production presents. And as it goes into the credits and you've got like black globules of oil dropping, he drops to the ground and walks off clearly in pain. And he's actually covering his shoulder. Like, you know that as you go into
the film. I
like that so much.
It's really clever how it's worked into the kind of the subtext of the title screen as well.
Yeah, absolutely. What do we think of the song?
I actually quite like it. I mean,
and
like
the title sequence. What do we think of both of them, really?
Oh, no, the title sequence itself, I think, is probably one of the prettiest. I mean, for me, Casino Royale will forever be like Danny Kleinman's prettiest sequence, but I think for me this is probably the second prettiest, I think. But I'm a bit fan of Garbage, but I'm not a fan of this film so much. I mean, Jenny, her vocals are really good. It's kind of another sultry kind of
is she trying to sing in a lower key than natural for her?
The normal, I guess, yeah, but it's kind of very sexy, very sultry. But a lot of the lyrics that she sings is actually quite pertinent to the film, obviously. It's the same as Carl last week, really. It's a good song, but probably not for Garbage, I guess, not for Shirley Manson.
I think she does. I quite like it. I mean, I like the version. I just think it's the song itself is just kind of okay. It's just above average. I mean, it's not never going to be one of the great ones, but it's serviceable. It does its job. It's not like some of the shit.
Serviceable. That's a good word. Yes.
It's not like some of the shit we end up getting, particularly next week. But
oh Christ.
It does its job and it sounds the part and I like the actual sequence itself. It's very psychedelic and obviously it plays a lot with oil, which is a theme in the film, which is like part to what the film is about, which again was nothing why I liked Daniel Kleinman's, because it's actually he has a running theme that's consistent with the film.
That's really good. Yeah, I like all the oil motifs. Yeah, that's really cool.
It looks pretty. It looks very like sort of like. Whoa, very vivid colours with lots of oil going everywhere, and it's like, yeah, so I like it, I have no problems with it.
The music video is quite fun as well, because they turn Shirley Manson into a robot.
Oh, no,
it's quite a cool music video.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's kind of quite lush, it's got a richness to it, and at the time, after Tomorrow Never Dies, this film felt very rich. It's even little things like Brosnan's dressed very well in this film.
He looks good.
And some of the set design is very lavish. And I just felt this film had a slightly luxury feel about it in 99. Whether a first-time viewer would sense that now, I doubt. But she sings it with quite a rich voice and it's got a very warm feel to it. I like it. I don't love it, but I like it a lot.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Agreed. All round. So after that, we come out to Scotland.
To bagpipes.
To the bagpipes.
And the funeral of Sir Robert King. And we meet Elektra. Now, I tend to think, and I suspect this would have passed some people by, but I bet there's a lot of people it didn't. Now, if you're going to have a story where you want to hide the fact that one of the children killed their parents, don't call her Elektra.
Yeah, that's a big giveaway, really, isn't it?
I don't think it's the wisest, and it wasn't necessary. You could have called her Victoria or anything, and it wouldn't matter.
I mean, like, I remember at the time, because I was old enough, it was like a new Bond film, excited, I was reading a lot about it, and I think they've kind of...
What were you, Chris, at the point? You were about 17 here, weren't you?
Yeah, and I was, about 17, that's great, yeah. I remember kind of like expecting her to... So when I was watching it from the get-go, I was kind of like, is she actually going to turn? I mean, they've kind of like talked around it, but kind of like made it obvious that's the direction they're going. It's interesting that her reveal to be the villain comes a lot earlier than I thought it actually was regularly. I always feel it should have done a lot later anyway. It should have been like third act type thing. But
I kind of agree. But again, I wish the sensibility... I know I keep on about this, listeners, but I wish the sensibility of the Daniel Craig era had been in place at this point. Do it a little bit later, that's fine, but then you don't have to crowbar in someone else for him to sleep with. Don't worry about that. His love in this film, and one of his loves of the series for my money, is Elektra. And I just think cramming in, and we'll talk about Denise Richards a little later in the show, but the fact is cramming her in doesn't help when you've got... It's bad enough when it's like You Only Live Twice with Aki, but it's even worse here where he genuinely does love her and you feel that. So cramming in some big-titted supermodel just doesn't work.
the thing, I agree with you. However, I don't... Yeah, it's a slight sort of feeling. I mean, you feel like that Bond is genuinely in love. I kind of think it's close, but that's why it hurts.
It's that's like, why it's so shocking at the end when he kills her. It's just like you really felt that connection there.
Yeah, I think that scene is played perfectly. But
brilliant.
I think it's the only woman to. I mean, it's not quite Tracy here, but
no, it's not. It is not that level. It could have been.
The way it's portrayed is fine. I just would have liked it to kind of like given a bit more meat. Like, there is, we are jumping ahead here, but there is a moment where Bond is like kind of onto her and he confronts her a bit, and then she kind of, there's a good nice little line of dialogue where she throws like, use me as bait, kind of saying, and that's all her, which kind of like throws the audience like, kind of like, oh shit, maybe she's not actually.
But Chris, when we were back at Majesty's, we were talking about how it could have been Brigitte Bardot, and I said then that like Bond would go for a Diana Rigg, not a Brigitte Bardot, and I feel the same way with this film, but it's in the same film that he would go for a Sophie Marceau, not a Denise Richards.
Yeah.
Which makes it all the more empty when he's with Denise Richards in the same film as Sophie Marceau.
Yeah, any
woman Bond ends up with is going to be beautiful, but she's not going to be Pamela Anderson. She's not going to be like fake tits and like blonde hair. Well, she could be blonde, obviously. I don't mean that, but she's not going to be plastic in any way. She's going to be a real, living, breathing woman with like intelligence and a personality, and Sophie Marceau sells me on that.
I think she is captivating in it. Like she just has the right look. She looks exotic, but she looks very interesting, shall we say? But not in like kind of like, oh, she looks a bit freaky. But she has like a natural beauty.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Becca, how did you perceive the relationships in this film?
Yeah, there's no chemistry between Bond and Christmas Jones. I think apart from Stacey, she's probably the worst Bond girl. There's just no charisma, just no chemistry between them. And just, oh, the cheesiness of the Christmas jokes at the end, I'm just like, I'll stick my things down my throat.
I'm gonna stick up for Denise Richards just a little bit.
No, just go for
little,
it, go for
little
it.
Bit. Like, obviously, aside from the whole... fact that the character's called Christmas Jones is a naff name anyway.
Jesus Christ. Is that Opposite Galore, or is it my outrageous name?
The character that's written isn't actually that bad. And...
Oh God, no, I've got a problem with the character. It's just the portrayal of it, really. That's
purely casting.
Yeah, and Denise Richards She is miscast. There's no two ways about it.
Miscast, however, yeah, that's my only issue.
And we are not saying, second, listeners, and I think Chris and Becca would both agree, we're not suggesting an attractive woman can't be intelligent, or even a younger woman.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's just that they have cast a playmate of the month. This woman does not sell. This woman does. Well, firstly, she probably is too young, to be fair. But even if you gave it that pass, this woman does not sell intelligent to us.
Wasn't she? Yeah. Not she got anything to do with it. Wasn't she Mrs. Charlie Sheen at the time?
No, that was a little bit later on.
Yeah,
but in fairness to her, in fairness to Denise Richards, she does give it all. She does like have fun. She turns up. She's there. Oh, I've got lots of quippy lines. Well, I'll at least give it my all. She's not just like turning up for the paycheck. She is at least trying.
Definitely.
So it's like, you know, I will say that in her defence. So Roberts is not a complete, you know, kicking on her.
Just miscast, yeah. Definitely. I mean, I think you can, you know, really when they go skipping ahead, but when they have to go into the pipe and sort of defuse the bomb. There's no other way that Bond could have done that, you know, without it and everything. But I do think there are certain aspects of it that are a little bit miscast.
That's not a rewrite. I'm not saying I could rewrite it here and now, but the fact is you could drop the Christmas Jones character and still have fundamentally more or less the same film.
Definitely. But otherwise, where Sophie Marceau's character is concerned, I definitely think there's much more of a connection there.
You could have given that bit to Colin Salmon and give his character a little bit more to do.
Anything.
We see Colin Salmon again.
But certainly, I do feel, I only feel sorry for Denise Richards in that she took the part, and why wouldn't you? She does her best with it. But it's very hard when the other leading lady in the film is Sophie Marceau.
Yeah, who's she's not got a lot to go up against.
A little bit older, very interesting, and a fully rounded, realised character, but also human being. You know, she's not a playmate of the month type, just in look or personality. And it's one of three times in the series, for me, listeners may disagree, that I've bought that Bond is in love. And, you know, that's a bad time for somebody like Denise Richards to go up against that. If Denise Richards had played the equivalent of a Mary Goodnight, we'd still say, well, she's not very good and she's miscast. But you don't have the competition of one of, like, the series' biggest chemistries to be fair,
she's a memorable character. That I mean, it's like you remember this film for probably like the boat chase. Sophie Marceau is the villain / leading lady, and also for, you know, Christmas Jones. So she's a memorable character. So, you know, well done.
Yeah, but anyway, one of the things that I do like and don't like at the same time is we cut after the funeral. We go straight to the sort of Scottish Highlands where MI6 have holed up after some terrorism. Now, I might not have looked like the underground stuff in Skyfall, but this doesn't make sense. Would you really leave the capital and go up to the middle of nowhere? But okay, let's take that.
Maybe it's just the HQ while it's being repaired, I don't know.
What is Bond doing there if he's injured? Chris is absolutely right. what I do like is there is a painting of Bernard Lee on the wall.
Yeah,
there is. Yeah, that's a nice nod, isn't it?
That's a nice nod. I like that.
And also, you see, there's a female double O. We don't know who she is, but
yes,
the
demo
section there's another female, so that's good. Hooray!
I just thought she was secretary. I'm kidding.
Shocking.
So I kind of like this, but the whole money exchange thing doesn't make sense because he takes the amount he's given and puts it into a translation thing. And it's exactly 5 million, and I'm thinking, well, hang on a minute. You've had Bilbao, you've gone back to London, you've done all that, you've been injured, you're now in London. Exchange rates change every day. How would this be exactly 5 million?
Yeah, you can't look into it too deeply.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Some of those things, it's Bond, isn't it? You've got to kind of give it's spend your disbelief.
Yeah, it's movie logic, you know, what should we say? It's not.
The whole point is, it's essentially the same as a ransom money.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line.
Yeah, we see Bond figure out it's actually a message from the, you know, so like from the terrorist who kidnapped her originally, which turns out to be Robert Carlyle Begbie.
And although it's rushed, I totally buy this. He's looking at the screen and he sees footage from BBC News of Elektra after her kidnap. Now, what we haven't said so far is she was kidnapped by Renard as an heiress to Sir Robert King's fortune, and she escapes and she is interviewed on BBC News and she's covered in a blanket. She's in shock. She's crying and she's doing, you know, a wonderful piece of acting and a wonderful scene. And Bond is touching the screen because he's really touched by this story. Now, as much as that's a bit rushed, I really buy this. I think Pierce Brosnan sells me this totally.
Yeah, you can say there's a connection there.
I think it also helps that it's also tied in with M and Judy Gents, because obviously she's like, takes it a bit personally. Now that King has died, she wants to protect Elektra at all costs. Because it's like, it's, she kind of takes it as a personal responsibility. Now, now Bond has actually got two things on his mind. One, he doesn't want to let down M, because he's got like a moral responsibility. And plus he is, as you say, genuinely touched and kind of feels like, I need to look after her. You know, he's got a general, you know, personally, he feels it personally. It's not just in a sense of duty. He's got that as well, but it adds to the relationship that goes on.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, Becca.
Yeah, no, I agree. One thing that also stands out to me in this film is how much more involved Emma is, how Judy Dench is. She gets out in the field and she becomes personally involved, you know, because of her dealings between her and King, and how basically they used Elektra as bait sort of the first time around. I think that's kind of that makes the stakes in this movie a lot more higher. The highest it's probably been in Brosnan's series. But you know, this scene really sells it to me. Brosnan sells it here, definitely. And we're talking about, you know, a beautiful woman also being intelligent. Sophie Marceau's character is probably one of the most well-rounded Bond girls in recent years, definitely. Because not only, you know, she's this kind of really, she can be kind of quite weak, quite strong at the same time. You know, totally three-dimensional character. But yeah, I agree wholeheartedly.
The only thing about her character that doesn't make sense is we see her properly introduced when Bond flies in and she arrives on a helicopter to speak to like that sacred ground. Sees that sacred ground and decides not to build around it. To build around it, not to like go through it as it was originally decided by her father. That just, you know, that's there to like kind of sell us that, oh, she's a good general person. But when she turns out to be bad, I kind of think, why would you give a shit? Like, you know, it just seems a little bit sort of like tagged it. That's my only criticism of her characterization that I kind of find a hard pill to swallow. And you know, it is what it is. But I find it difficult to swallow the fact that that character being like generally like twisted would actually go no, I'll go around it. I mean, it's not really established why she'd want to do that. If there's like any other motive, unless I missed something, but
yeah, it does seem a bit odd, doesn't it? Mm.
Yes, it does. It does. She's trying to win a PR war at this stage, and I think that's kind of all right. I think it kind of works, and that's okay.
Desmond Wren's last movie, SQ. He died in a car accident shortly after the film was released. I remember being on the news. I was like, oh no.
It was really bizarre because I was at university at the time and I went in one day for like an Irish politics course I was doing. And we were talking about the Bond film and someone said to me, well, Desmond Llewellyn's dead, isn't he? And I said, no, he's still alive. And literally about 5 days later, he died.
He died in a car accident. It's like, what? But that was very spooky. But no, instead we got John Cleese as R. Obviously, Q stood for quartermaster, but obviously, R being the next letter.
Well, no, that was a joke.
That was the in-joke. Yeah,
he is the next Q.
So he's the next Q, pretty much. But, what would you reckon to R? How do you rate John Cleese?
I mean, it's a bit of an odd scene. I mean, I guess we will see John Cleese, how he fares next week. He's
the QC next week.
The thing about Desmond Llewellyn's performance, like, I think, I can't remember when exactly... By the time I watched it, whether he died before the news came out that he died after he watched it, I can't quite remember, but I do remember thinking, that is so fucking eerie. It's almost as if they knew. They knew this would be his last film, because the way it ends, it's very, it's like a perfect send off to him and that character.
Yeah, yeah.
You see him go down, don't you? And you think, oh dear.
He was attempting to come back.
Yeah.
But there's nothing in this scene that tells you that.
No, they were kind of like prepping for like his retirement, but it's just like it's very weird watching it back and then also knowing that he died, you know, a few weeks later, and you think, oh Christ, you know, very strange. But I think John Cleese is hilarious. Actually, I find him quite funny.
Well, he's kind of like played as the joke. I mean, it's why it's kind of crazy. It's like a good send off for Desmond Llewellyn, because it's the first real time that both Bond and Q team up in the lab and just kind of like really cool at John Cleese. You know, it's like, oh, pull the damn cord.
No, that's a nice twist, isn't it? Usually he's kind of like, oh God, up and, you know, just get out of my sight, you know, all the rest of it. And for once they're actually like, oh, just get on with it, you know, they're in unison together, so.
Yeah. Has he really taught Bond, never see you bleed? Never let him see you bleed? Has he really taught him that? But
it's poignant, though.
It plays nice, doesn't it?
It's a nice send-off.
Yeah.
I just thought we mentioned that because it's...
And always have an escape route.
Well, that's kind of one. Obviously, all the gadgets that he's been given, you know, you can use to get out somehow. So,
it's a nice sort of way to do it. So,
yeah,
but very odd.
Bless him. Anyway, yes, the Tracy reference, Dave. Come on, fill us in.
Well, it's just simply that she says to him, "Have you ever lost anyone you love?" And there is a very long pause, a slight bristle, and a change of subject.
Yeah, that's not the reference. I don't know what is.
It has to be.
I mean, it is called The World's Not Enough as well, so they were thinking of the unmarried season on some level.
Been the family motto, so.
Yeah. I think there are something. Obviously, he's got a ski sequence as well later on. There are
echoes of Majesty's running through this.
But I always love little references to Tracy, little sort of things like that. That always like sort of perks my ear up a little bit. So it's a shame Craig never had one. But I suppose he had Vespa, doesn't he? Not rather than Tracy.
Oh, definitely. I'm quite happy with what Craig got in terms of like that sort of thing. Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, anyway, so yeah, Bond gets a clean bill of health from the amazingly named Dr. Ward, Molly Warm Flash, oh my god. And yeah, and just off to Azerbaijan, so.
I once heard somebody say to me that they thought that the scene with Molly Warm Flash made them extremely uncomfortable, that they said that it was a bit rapey.
Really?
I think that answers the question I was about to ask. Is that the way any of you would feel about that? I don't think so.
Which is basically Bond being Bond, isn't he? Just all creams on in there and...
It struck me as a bit of an overreaction, but I don't want to ridicule people for their opinions.
I suppose it's a bit like in Thunderball, isn't it? Where he seduces Pat Fearing at Shrublands pretty much to get him out of there. So it's that kind of same scenario, isn't it? But that's just what Bond does. He's humanizer, but yeah, it's a bit creepy.
I mean, like, there's definitely like they clearly established that they've slept together before. They've clearly had some remote history, you know. And from my recollection, she kind of like instigates like at least the sexual aspect of it, and then like Bond goes, oh yeah, well, and then kind of does his thing.
And you got the catty comments from Moneypenny as well.
Unless I'm just misremembering it, I don't know, but I'm kind of with Dave. It's just like, I just take it for like, well, it's just Bond being Bond, you know, it's just like, yeah.
I just didn't want to ridicule that opinion, but...
Somebody's opinion, then that's fine.
I might watch it again and think, like, fucking hell, but I don't know, but I'll bear in mind next time I watch it.
So, no, yeah, Azerbaijan.
For the fifth time.
Let's get into the mission.
Yeah, but yeah, actually, it takes us, what, about like half an hour to get into the actual meat and potatoes of it. So yeah, they're going to check out a pipeline, and we see cameo from Stan... Oh, is it a comic, really? Omar Jalili. I can never pronounce his name.
Omar Jalili.
No, it was this weird kind of time where he started popping up in big films, like he was in The Mummy as well, wasn't he?
He was.
So yeah, it was like, well, fucking hell, he was like...
He's the man du jour.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, so yeah, he pops up, he's one of the familiar faces. And we get a first real scene with Sophie Marceau, and yeah, it's how you want it. There's like, she's a bit frosty with him at first because she's like, well, I don't really want MI6's help, you know, sod off.
That's pretty much like, what she says.
No, I'm sticking around. I'm not taking no for an answer. So she kind of goes like, okay, well, do you like skiing? And he goes, yep. So they go off. Let's go off skiing, and then we get like this. This action scene, which is pretty okay. What I think we remember while watching this was not Tom Arnold,
David Arnold.
I think he does an incredible John Barry impression, and it sounds almost demeaning when I say it's an impression because it is very John Barry, but it sounds as almost if like if John Barry came back and did a piece of music that I can't. That's exactly what it will sound like. So I think he did an incredible job with the intro to the snowy landscape.
I'd have to agree with you there, definitely. I think. I think this is the second one score that I bought on CD, obviously the first being Tomorrow Never Dies. But yeah, my two favourite pieces of music are in this film. Boat Chase, I think the score there is really cool. I remember listening it too many times on the bus to college. And also the music that accompanies, you know, when they're kind of shushing down the hills, as it were. My two favourite music in the, you know, whole entire film. But yeah, it definitely is a John Barry impression, and it sounds all the better for it. Dave, what do you reckon?
The score, it's not as Barry-esque as I thought it would be, actually. It's an awful lot more percussive and electronic than I thought it was. Listening to it tonight, because I listened to it just thinking, well, he's a Barry analogue. Well, he's not actually, not as much as I thought.
There's elements of it in the strings for sure.
Yeah, I mean, like in that piece of music. I mean, generally, like there are in more moments, in the more action type moments, he does like to break out the whole like, oh, we'll just remix it all up and have a little bit of a, you know, like a sort of a techno sort of like fast sort of beat. And he's just like, I'm not so keen on. I think that's maybe it's. Well, I think at the time it was probably more acceptable, but now it just feels a little bit more dated. But when it comes to like more classier that kind of stuff, he does a good job, particularly here in that sort of opening scene. It just sounds very sort of lush. But when the action kicks in, it's like goes all turntables at the ready, and it's like wicka, 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 and it's like, oh, do we really have to do that?
Yeah, drum and bass heavy, isn't it?
Yeah. But so what do you think of this action scene?
Yeah, I think the attack by the Powerhawks. It's quite a good scene. I think it's probably one of the best action sequences in the movie after the boat chase. As I say, you know, perfectly serviceable. But it's a good action scene. That's all I can say about it.
I kind of agree. I mean, it's only tonight I noticed that he jumps out of like the helicopter and starts skiing. And it's a much taller, bulkier man, you know, and all the rest of it. But it's not too bad. It's done pretty well. I think a lot of the Brosnan was a bit tick list, and it was time to see him on skis. Do you know what I mean? But the sequence is fine, and I've heard a lot of people like slate it, and I think it's okay. It's not bad at all.
I think what works is afterwards, you know, where they have like a nice little moment where Lecter's like panicking underneath the snow, and he calms her down again. That adds to like the emotion and of the character.
It does.
She's very manipulative.
So wants to help this woman.
Yeah,
I really like that.
And it's almost kind of like it gets to Bond now because he just wants to kind of like just. It's that classic sort of like thing of falling in love with a girl because you want to like look after them, you know, and take care of them. You know, it's just like, it's nicely done. She's panicking, going like, oh my god, I can't breathe, can't breathe.
I am sure with Sophie Marceau, there have been times over the years because she's an attractive woman and was a model and everything else. She probably wasn't taken seriously as an actress, but I have to say, she is really, really good in this scene. That scene under the snow, I deliberately watched her and did not take my eyes off her while she was panicking under the snow tonight, and it was great. She was so good.
She's really convincing, isn't she?
Yeah, I'd absolutely say so. Where do we go from there?
Do we go back to don't they have a love scene? Am I just no? Actually, don't they go to the casino first?
Yeah, we go to Baku, and yeah, you have the scene between Bond and Electra. But we go to Zhukovsky's he's a legitimate businessman now, and he's running a casino.
Yes, absolutely.
So we also see Bond with his X-ray specs as well.
Is it just me, or is those X-ray specs really like redundant? Like you could have easily had that scene without them. It just made no. It's like, oh, right, so we can see they're all wearing guns. Well, we can all assume they're all having guns.
It's, like, it's a chance for Bond to pervert the underwear, really, isn't it, pretty much?
Well, kind of. And it doesn't help that Pierce Brosnan looks fucking ridiculous wearing these blue tinted shades.
He does look silly. It was the late 90s, after all, you know.
Yeah, I guess. But, yeah. anyway, with it here we meet Goldie as Mr. Bullion.
What the hell is he doing in this film? Oh my god! So
well, he's got gold teeth. You know, it is the whole let's give them a physical thing.
No, is it? He's good laugh in this movie, though. I think. I mean, he's obviously DJ, respected producer, but it's just like
put his money where his mouth is.
Yeah. Can't argue with that.
But in terms of. Valentine Skoski. It's nice to see Robbie Coltrane come back.
I agree, and I think he is much, much better here than he was in Goldeneye.
That's funny, because I generally think his scene in Goldeneye is probably better than any the scenes that is in here, really. Not that I think it's bad. I mean, I do like his presence, but I think I really like his scene in Goldeneye. But here, he's a lot more friendly to Bond. It's like, oh, Bond, James Bond, oh, glad to see you. Whereas this time he's like, no, I can't decide whether to kill you or what. But here there's a bit more playfulness to it. You know, he's like, you know, there's kind of.
I thought they had better chemistry in this film.
Oh yeah, but they have more scenes together though, so there is
probably development. So I did say during the Goldeneye show that I thought it was we were missing some editing,
but yeah, I really like it's just like, oh, good, they're bringing back old characters. Yes, you know, and not necessarily thingamajig from the last couple of films.
Who's that then?
Felix Leiter 0.210.
Yeah, pretty much.
There's a little bit of warmth. He's very playful, you know, like particularly with some of the dialogue, like, can you just knock like a regular person?
I love his when this whole factory falls apart as well. It's like the insurance company, you're never going to believe this. I remember at the cinema that I got a massive laugh from my audience, so, and that always makes me laugh.
And you feel kind of sad when he dies, spoiler alert, but yeah, we are joking. Yeah.
Definitely.
Mild spoiler alert, people.
I still thought at this point we'd get at least a couple more Brosnan films, and I thought he'd be part of them after this.
No, it's a shame to see him killed off, but...
Yeah, I'd agree.
And obviously he also had, obviously Bean Cracker, and... Oh God, what's his name? Robert Carlyle also appeared in an episode of Cracker, so it's good that you kind of see them together.
He did, and what an episode it was. I must say to anyone listening, if you've never seen... And I know we have listeners in other countries... look up the Robbie Coltrane series Cracker, and I'm trying to remember what the episode was called. I think it was To Be a Somebody or something like that. But certainly Robert Carlyle played like a Liverpool football club fan, very scarred by what happened at Hillsborough, and he is chilling and absolutely terrific in that series.
He's really scary, isn't he?
Isn't in that series of episodes with Robert Carlyle, is that the same one where Doctor Who gets killed, you know, Christopher Eccleston?
Yes, he does.
That's the one,
killed,
yeah.
He's killed by Robert Carlyle, who plays a character called Albie Kinsella. Yeah.
Utterly terrifying, yeah, definitely try and seek it out if you can.
Kills him with his granddad's bayonet.
Mm.
Yeah,
interesting touch.
Amazing episode, which I would recommend to anyone listening to this. So, and also, once you add in like Trainspotting, where he was brutal as Begbie,
then
I can see why you would think he would be a scary villain, but I don't think they've quite realised it here.
I don't think they've given him enough time on. I like things. I like his character. I like his conception. And I think I like him cast as a, you know, I think his opening scene where he's picking up the rocks, you know, I kind of like the kind of casualness and how he is clearly just numb to everything and just like, I mean, it, again, this is before 9/11, but he is like a terrorist with nothing to lose. He does not care if he gets killed. And you know he will complete the mission regardless. You know, it's like
he's always going on about death and how he's died already and how he's already dead. And yeah. He mentions that quite a lot throughout the film.
Yeah,
doesn't he, so.
Yeah. When Bond threatens to shoot him, it's like, you know, go ahead, do it. I'll welcome it. My friend hit a shot. And,
yeah.
And then Yeah. So it's like it's very kind of I like him as a character. I like Robert Carlyle's performance. I just wish we had a bit more of it. You know.
I think it's more the fact that if you introduce somebody where you say they have no feelings, they are losing their senses, and they can push themselves harder for every day for the rest of their lives, I would expect much more than holding a hot rock and putting their hand through a table.
Yeah, kind of the physicality doesn't quite match up to the expectations we're given.
I mean, this is like the flaw of the film. It's kind of like this. It's like establishes Bond kind of wounded, and then it only really sort of like plays up that as like as a reference point when he sort of touches him on the shoulders, like, and Pierce Brosnan goes "ow" for a bit, you know. And you know, as much it just isn't really well thought out. But then that scene where Brosnan is confronted with Renard for the first time is played really well. I like the dialogue, I like the interaction between the two, but it's just, I just wish I had more.
The only problem I've got is where he says, "Huh?" He says to him, "No point living if you can't feel alive," which he's just heard from Elektra.
Hmm.
And the way he says "Huh?" is like he's read.
Oh, is that
that's the moment. He's like he's read that off a speech bubble in a comic book. And the scene that I've got a problem with is one where he confronts Elektra. There's no point living if you can't feel alive. He's not very good in that sequence. They're the only two bits in the film I've got a problem with, though, because I think the rest of this film, I think he's really, really good.
You know, people often debate, like, who's... Well, not people often debate, Bond fans debate, who's the real villain in this movie? Is it Renard or is it Elektra?
Elektra.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly. This is it. But I think, Renard's definitely more of the henchman. But I think, I rate Robert Carlyle as an actor, obviously Trainspotting as a high point. He's in quite a lot since. But I think here it's kind of a little bit disappointing, but it's all about Sophie Marceau, pretty much. It's all about her, her manipulation of Bond, and yeah, you know, just is her as the villain, really. So
well, she's the one like kind of playing, because I don't really think she actually loves Renard as much as Renard actually believes it.
No, she's playing both of them pretty much, isn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, essentially, she's just using him to do a bidding. Like, well, you know,
I don't think the film's thought that out, because the film is trying to postulate she's got Stockholm syndrome, which means she would be completely devoted to him. But again, it's kind of not sure on that and whether she's playing him or not. And also, she slept with Bond, and so the theory is he's turned her head. I don't think the film's figured this out. It's not very consistent in the way it characterises her in the second half.
Yeah, I don't know, you can kind of buy it that be Bond's go-to explanation for it without knowing too much.
Yeah.
But that's about as far as it would ever go. It's like, you know, that's all the film really gives you. Other than her performance. And her performance tells me that, no, she's actually psychotic. She is playing, like, people to do her bidding for her, and to her own kind of twisted end, really. And she's quite sort of, she just doesn't care about anyone. You know, she just, you know, she's quite petulant, you know. Even though a plan doesn't make any sense, like, okay, you want to kill M, so you kidnap her. just
kill her. Yeah.
It's like. But yeah, you know, I kind of like that twist. I just wished it happened later in the film to be a bit more meaningful and powerful.
Yeah, they just haven't thought a lot of this through, and after this, she becomes very childish, very everyone loves me, like a beauty queen or something. Where'd you get that from then? I mean, I do think he fell in love with you, but where did you assume any of that?
Yeah, it's a bit weird, a bit one-sided.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
so
just like her, that's just like her own sense of grandeur, isn't it? She's trying to justify it, I guess. That just kind of shows like how twisted
and,
she really
and
is.
And also, we're trying to find a part for Christmas Jones through all of this.
Oh God.
And I don't get any of that at all.
No, well, why would you? I mean, like, even at the time, even, like, the 17-year-old me would be like, yeah, Denise Richards, she's hot, but okay, it's a bit of a naff casting call, isn't it, really? It's quite a cry for desperation, if you're asking me, but it just doesn't sit right, especially when, as you say, you got Marcy Marceau. By God! What's wrong with me? Sophie Marceau.
Marcel Marceau.
He's somebody else completely different.
You know, Miss yeah, when you got Sophie Marceau, who, you know, is just head above shoulders above everyone else, you know, in this film. As a Bond-lean lady, like, clearly, like, the best one that Brosnan has had. And I liked her first one, you know, Isabel Scorpio. But, yeah, no. It just sounds a little bit desperate when you cast Denise Richards. It's like, oh, we'll get all the 15-year-olds who kind of secretly read FHM and...
It's the stunt casting. We get it again next week. It's like, she is not a Bond girl in any way, shape or form. And they've
An Oscar. She's an Oscar winner, so we'll get
her. Well, next week's is, but we're talking about Denise Richards.
I don't imagine...
She's a Razzie winner, isn't she?
Yes, she is.
Conversely.
But the fact is, it's like, why have you cast this woman? She doesn't suit Bond. She doesn't suit the role. But, like, Wild Things was released the year before. And it's like, you are pandering to the audience, and it's not the way to go. It just isn't.
It reminds you more of Roger Moore as well.
In what way?
In the fact that you just don't buy that. They're just mishmash. They're just mixed-mash couple. They're not, like... He's clearly, like, in his 40s, and she's, what, 20,
about
mid-20s?
28. About 28, I think.
Yeah, and then she just looks like, I just don't see them. You look them together, like, that's not a screen couple, in by any stretch of imagination, you know. It's just not, no, just not right.
No.
So,
I find, like, between like, the relationship between Bond and Electro far more believable than Bond and Christmas Jones, unfortunately. Just because of the...
But it's not a relationship. It's a he needs to shag someone at the end of this film.
Yes, it's the trophy, isn't it? Trophy again.
They don't need this woman in the film. They are totally... He has pretty much worked out she's the villain. And the film dies when he heads off from her to go and replace Davidoff or whatever it is. Where he meets Christmas Jones, the film dies there, and they are going off to kind of Christmas Jones as an active character in the film has kind of died at that point, so it's just not thought through at all.
I mean, look, I think I've got to mention that I do like that whole bit where he sneaks on the plane. Is it where he zooms the place of is it Darren?
Yes, it is. He takes Davidoff's place. Yeah,
I like.
Oh, yeah, Davidoff dies, and then is it Dr. Arkoff?
Dr. Arkoff gets killed, Davidoff gets shot by Bond from the...
Oh yeah, and then he assumes Davidoff's position, yeah.
That's quite clever. It's very convoluted, but I like the moment how like they ask him like, have you got it? And he's like, he's got like a duffel bag, so he just kind of like blags it, and shakes the bag, as if, yeah, I've got it, let's have a look. And he's...
It's a pair of trainers.
That pair of trainers. He's like, he's thinking, excellent. And he's like, oh well, there you are then. I like that little sort of moment of like tension and a little bit of like playfulness to it. I forgot to mention. That's one of the things I really like about it. But I think it just feels, it just becomes a bit limp. I think it's probably the right word. A bit weak and limp. Like whole story and the plotting and the action. It just comes very, and then this happens and this happens and then this happens. And all you've got is the kind of the premise that your leading Bond girl is now a villain, and she's doing a really, really good job, and you bought their relationship. And that's what carries you through it, really. Other than that, it just kind of very much... like
the film just struggles from here on. We start moving our focus to Christmas Jones, who's not a good character, I've got problems with Reynard's great as an idea, and he's set up as this terrifying villain that everyone's really scared of. And he's got no feelings. So you think, well, Christ, what sort of fight is he going to have with Bond? Well, none of that is played up. Mm. And so you end up with the focus shifting to someone you don't care about and who isn't played very well, away from Sophie Marceau towards basically Playmate of the Month. And the whole plot just goes completely wrong. From here on in, the film is actually terrible.
Yeah, it's going down a little bit from here.
I can't argue too much because I kind of agree with you. I mean, I don't feel about it as strongly as you do, and so I would say it's terrible. But yeah, I can't really disagree with too much what you say because it is very like. Yeah. I mean, it has a nice sort of set piece with the caviar place with the. Helicopters with blades, which was going to be used in GoldenEye originally, which is where we have that car sequence that was shelved. So there is that, and then it's. I think the problem with me is like the action just feels limp, you know. Like so the way that it's. I know we've mentioned we said it before, and it's like hard to really sort of blame Michael Apted, but. You know, when people like sort of flying or like sort of shooting people with assault machine guns, and they're just kind of like waving about as if like they're clearly just made out of like hollow plastic. Mm. It's just like there's no gravitas to it. It's just like, oh really?
Like, it just looks like a throwaway scene, doesn't it? It doesn't look very believable at all.
No, it's just it's like even the assault on Electra's place at the end just feels very kind of. Just thrown together, like sort of say, "Oh, we'll just show up with some guns and people fall over," you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a bit okay. But anyway, so M's now captured, and she's locked up in a. Are they in a lighthouse or some sort of
something like that?
It's yeah, like, so... Is it the Maiden's Tower? Isn't it up in on the Bosphorus? But I think it's quite an important scene because obviously it's the first time that we've seen that M generally doesn't get involved. Well, certainly Dame Judi Dench at M hasn't been involved, and this is probably the first time that we see her kind of like out and about in the field, as it were. No, just I rate this film quite high. This section of the film quite highly.
Well, because of the fact that M's involved in the action, so to speak.
Yeah, it kind of raises the stakes a little bit higher.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of get why she would be there to be captured by Electra initially, but again, it's like, well, why is she keeping her there? Why is she kidnapping her? That film does not explain, and it just kind of like puts Judi Dench like in a cell essentially for the rest of the film. And it's funny because like when Bond's like running past after running after a lecture, it's just kind of like an afterthought. It's like M just calls out Bond, and he just lets you go. Stop! Oh yeah,
oh, yeah there you are.
And just runs off.
It doesn't even bother to ask how she is.
Well, you know he's on the chase, but it just feels like an afterthought. It just feels like.
And then you wonder how does she get home? I'm like, oh, obviously she's extracted somehow. But it's like, how does she get back to London? You know.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's quite important because obviously she basically you know kind of used the whole like big aspect of it. And that's Electra's way of getting revenge, pretty much, isn't it? It's like, right, okay, you know, you screwed up my family, I'm going to screw you up, and obviously Bond's very close to you, and just, you know, that's it, pretty much. That's Electra getting her revenge. That's how I see it, anyway. But yeah, it's kind of it's handled quite lazily, you must admit. Could be written a bit better, but it's always good to see out and about, I think.
What do we think of the ultimate pain face from
The epic pain face, isn't it? We're getting forward a little bit ahead of ourselves, aren't we? In the torture chair.
Even
at the time, I know there's a lot of contrived dangers Bond endures, but this just seemed too contrived. I've always struggled with this bit, and even when I loved this film, I was like, "Don't do that! It just doesn't feel right."
No, it's a little bit cheesy.
I liked Bond goading him, saying like, "Oh yeah, just like just another screw, love," you know, and while she's just like sort of twisting it in, but Yeah, I think it's just like his face is just like, oh, for God's sake. It's just like. again, his escape's kind of lazy as well. Like, where, you know, it's, you know, obviously Robert Coltrane comes in. He, like, go, give it to me. It's like he's bothered about a hat. You know, like, why don't you shoot her and pick it up? Like, you know, it's just. Okay. But.
Why doesn't he just shoot her rather than shoot? You know, Bond's
because this film's not very well thought through.
No, exactly. Like, just shoot Electro while you got the chance, damn it.
But, yeah, but whatever. and then we've got Electro's big bodyguard who Bond easily beats up.
Yeah, he's massive, at least twice his size. So
there's a scene early on where Bond breaks into Electro's place and he just like hears like punching sound and hear like this guy like clearly like Lennox Lewis type sort of fire and his brother standing over him and like just not a gal. It's just like, oh come on. But he's kind of like your shot. And then we get the chase and then we get that scene, which I think all of us like, do we like, you know, when Electro's death scene?
I don't know. I still don't know. 17 years on, I don't know. I don't know what I think of this at all. I don't like the second half of this film. And I think everything in terms of, like, you know, closing down the plot is a bit disappointing. And Electra runs off like a giggly schoolgirl for no reason. And when Bond gets there, she's still totally confident in everyone loves her for no reason we can think of. And I'm still confused. I don't hate it, but I'm just, am I supposed to like this? I don't know what I think.
No, I think she just kind of sees her plan coming together. She's kind of like giddy on her own success, I guess, or kind of like what she imagines is going to happen. And she's like, oh, you can't kill me in cold blood. You'd miss me, blah, blah, blah. And he just kind of just obviously shoots her. I never miss. And I just think, oh my God, it's still, you know, I'm the same as you, Dave. I believe you should, that, you know, there was kind of like in love earlier in the film, and for him to kind of kill her this way, it still really shocks me.
I know,
but again, I guess it's like the cold nature of a business, really.
It's like he's a grown man talking to a petulant teenager.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's not what that relationship was, and that's not what Electra was. So I'm always a bit disappointed by this, but I stand by it. I don't know what to think of it, because, like, I don't know what I would expect to be in its place.
Emotionally, it's a bit strange, isn't it? But, I mean, it sounds, you know, it's, you know, Bond is pretty much an assassin, isn't he, at the end of the day, so it's still very much, you know, cold-hearted, but you just think, oh, it still shocks me personally.
Yeah, I think the only thing I have is just sounds a little bit wrong, which, like, Renard, dive, and Bond's, and she gets shot. It just sounds a little bit kind of, doesn't quite sound as punchy as it could have been, but, like, I like what is actually written, in so to speak, I like it.
But you'll miss me, I never miss. That's a bit of a strange time for a pun.
Yeah, it doesn't quite sit right.
But there you go.
Yeah, I guess.
It is what it is.
But anyway. Then but we get, like,
that says a lot. I mean, I'm looking at the sort of recording time here. We were worried that this was going to be an epically long podcast because of how long it took us to get to the film. And once you get to the film, there's not that much to talk about. We've talked quite a lot, but at the same time...
We're coming near the end of it now.
Second half of the film, we're at an hour and 40 on the recording time here. Obviously, the edit will be different. But it's just like, well, what else is there to say? This film, it just doesn't do anything we thought it was going to do.
It falls apart in the last 20 minutes, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does, sadly. It just feels flimsy. But, as I said, there are good stuff in there that kind of just keep me interested, keep me in there, that I kind of like.
Yeah.
I say, I mean, like, the whole submarine bit just feels a little bit, like, tagged on. But I remember at the time, it was like, because it wasn't used in any of the publicity, well, at least not that I can remember, it felt actually surprised, felt like, oh shit, we've got another sequence here that I hadn't seen anything, which was kind of like a nice little surprise.
Yeah,
I don't remember too much publicity about it as well, because I remember being on a field trip at school this time, and I think seeing it on, like, GMTV or the equivalent back in the day, and they obviously, like, Azerbaijan and Russia and everything, and I was like, oh, I don't remember the bit on the sub, you know, didn't see much publicity about that. So I've got five facts. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay, are they all fun? I hope I have fun this.
This needs to be like, you know, 90s chat line quality.
Oh. Pizza fact. Well, number fact number one. So yeah, the jet boat designer Doug Riddle made 15 bits for the film, including the custom machine that you see with the V8 engine with 300 brake horsepower, which is pretty cool. Number two, at the time of shooting,
folks.
That's fun. That's a fun fact.
Chris and I are now hard. And I'm not sat with Chris. I'm guessing, but I bet I'm right.
I've got three more of these to go. You know, jeez.
God, we'll have. Yeah, we'll need a change of underwear and trousers.
Obviously, we didn't discuss this section, but in the film, Bond drives the BMW Z8. But obviously, at the time of shooting, the car hadn't actually come to market yet, so he had to use prototypes. Yeah, obviously, with next week, Dine of the Day, starring an Oscar winner, Denise Richards earned the Bond series its first Razzie. Ugh. What else have we got? Yeah, so fact number four, I didn't realise that the film was very nearly directed by Peter Jackson. How good would that have been?
Yeah, it turned out Barbara Broccoli did not like The Frighteners, so that was the end of that.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting, but it's one of those kind of, it's like, what would, you know, what would have happened if Quentin Tarantino had directed it? What would have happened if...
They liked Heavenly Creatures, and they liked Heavenly Creatures. That's what put it on the radar.
That's a good film. I can recommend that if you haven't seen it.
They didn't like The Frighteners. And
Was it the fact that they did not like The Frighteners, or I read that she did not think the style suited Bond, because it's very kind of...
It's quite dreamlike and kind of quite always either the horror aspect
very kind of gothic, and I mean, I love The Frighteners. I think that's a great film.
Yeah, me too.
I'm not sure... If she didn't like it, well, more fault her, but she's wrong. But, I would say maybe she just didn't think the style lended itself. But then again, Peter Jackson probably would not have done it, because he'd probably be off shooting Lord of the Rings. So.
Yeah, he made that around that time, didn't he? So yeah. He was like, screw you, I'm going to make Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, Bob Locke's like, oh, shit.
Bugger, is that one up for something that? Yeah, especially after it won all the Oscars. And obviously my fifth fact was about Desmond Llewellyn dying, so, well, very sad. Which we discussed earlier in the podcast.
Yeah, really sad. I mean, he was such a stalwart of this series, wasn't he? I mean, we have to mention it. I mean, I've sounded like I don't like Desmond Llewellyn. I really like Desmond Llewellyn, by the way. I just don't think he's a particularly great actor, but he was perfect for this series. And we did feel him not being there. And I'm so glad the first couple of Craig entries had no Q. Because there was no point of comparison. They were building their new universe.
No, Skyfall was the right time to bring it in.
I agree, very much.
Anyway, Chris, what do you think?
Well, there's not enough closing thoughts?
Yes, closing thoughts. What do you reckon?
Closing thoughts.
I know, my final thoughts.
Final thought. Well, we've kind of gone through the film. It's kind of like, we sounded all very kind of like, well, this is all positive and but lots of things to chat about. And then we got to the end and it's like, the plot of the film kind of like just loses our interest. But I think we kind of like, it's part of what we came too soon. We kind of like, we went all in about all the stuff we like. Then by the time we got to the end, like, we've already kind of exhausted the stuff we liked. That's happened, gone before. So, I think that's what's happened here. It's still my favourite Brosnan. It's still watchable. There's still got shades of things to like about it. It is kind of flimsily put together, but I can overlook that. Just because I think it's Brosnan's best performance. It has some interesting beats. I like the lead. I like the cast, so to speak. I just turn a blind eye to the naffness of some of it, but that's my fault.
Naffness, that's a good word.
I think GoldenEye probably still stands as his best film, but that's a red herring. This was his only shot at greatness. If Brosnan was ever to have had a great James Bond film, this was going to be it. And as this didn't quite work out, I kind of think he didn't. But James Bond, there's been six James Bonds, and there's been three love stories in the series, and as far as I'm concerned, and Brosnan owns one of them, and it's this film. So it's notable for that reason, and it's certainly not a bad film. I don't understand why people put it bottom. Well, no, I do understand why people put it bottom, but I never would. I think this is okay. I just think it falls apart around halfway, but that's not unusual for the Bond series. But yeah, I still like it.
Because a lot of that time, some people are giving it like worst Bond film ever kind of like thing, and it's like, yeah. But then we just wait till the next one.
yeah, this is it. They haven't seen Die Another Day, have they? Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, I missed this one when we got to Die Another Day, because at least this film had some emotion and love in it. I don't want Bond to fall in love in every film. That would be ridiculous. But it's nice to have some real emotions you can cling on to. And Die Another Day
had
none of it. And neither did Tomorrow Never Dies. GoldenEye tried this, tried. So that's why these are the top two for Brosnan for me. Not everyone's going to agree, and I understand why. But, like, yeah, this was Brosnan's shot at greatness, and they didn't quite do it, which is a shame.
Yeah, it's not really down from Brosnan either. It's, you know, it's, I think, you know, as I've said, like, I think everything else just lets him down. It's like the production has let him down more than anything, rather than, like, the scripts let him down. You know, I think Brosnan's always gone in, wants to give a great Bond every time, and I think the things are, I think he does his best with what he's given.
Yeah, definitely. And yes, I don't like that. There's no point living if you can't feel alive in the... But I mean, that is a total of about 2 minutes out of a couple of hours of Brosnan absolutely proving he could do so much with this role that he wasn't given chance to do.
No, definitely, I agree with that for sure. But I think in terms of, like, ranking the Brosnans, I think that's why it's kind of on a sliding scale for me. I mean, like, GoldenEye was the first one. Whenever it dies, it was pretty much shoot 'em up Bond. But I think this one, they had so, for The World Is Not Enough, there's so much promise in terms of, like, character development. And Elektra's probably one of the most well-rounded characters in Bond Girls, for sure, that we've seen in recent years. But yeah, the last 20 minutes kind of just falls apart, really, to be honest. I didn't really think a lot of it through. But yeah, I agree with you guys. There's so much greatness written in his DNA, but it wasn't fully realised. But I appreciate, you know, everyone worked hard, did their best on this film, and Apted coming where he's coming from, obviously being primarily a kind of documentary director for, like, 7-Up and things like that. They just can't, you know, do what they could with the best material they had at the time. And fair enough, and this was the product. But
How well did this do at the box office?
Oh, it was the highest grossing to this point, but not by a lot. GoldenEye was in the 350 millions. Tomorrow Never Dies was in the 330s, but it opened opposite Titanic. This was in the 360s, so adjusted for inflation, it's probably a little bit behind GoldenEye, but in absolute terms, it was the highest grossing at this point. Did pretty well.
Yeah, so it must have still struck a chord with audiences. I mean, like, I don't know what it is, what makes a Bond film a hit.
No, nor do I.
It's a mixture of factors, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, because even Die Another Day, that did really well.
And that was awful.
Die Another Day is if you adjusted for inflation, Die Another Day is his most successful.
Yeah, it's his highest grossing Bond movie, isn't it?
Yeah, but even adjusted, it just did really, really well, proving...
It was the 40th anniversary as well, wasn't it? So.
Yeah, it was.
I have a lot to do with it, I think.
I kind of like this film. I don't like it as much as I used to, and there are things about this film I really don't like, but there's a part of me that's only human, and I'm kind of embarrassed when I hear that, like, everybody hates this, and I actually thought it was the best Brosnan for years. And I still think, like, there's things about this film that, like, almost touches Majesty's.
Well, you like what you like, you know, don't worry about that.
But the overall effect is nowhere near Majesty's. I'm not saying it's one of the better Bond films, but it's one of the few that, like, touch that greatness. And GoldenEye, whether you love it or not, never does that. GoldenEye...
That's one of Pierce's better Bond films.
GoldenEye could aspire to be, like, a Goldfinger, maybe, in terms of quality, but, like, Majesty's is on a different plane, and you need to do something a bit different to do that. And there aren't many Bond films that did it. Casino Royale did, and I kind of think this was going that way. It just let itself down. Christmas Jones appeared at 57 minutes and something. Before that, it's a good film. Yeah, I did. I looked today, but before that, it's a good film. Before that, it's a very good film.
I mean, in fairness to it, like, it's about over 2 hours, isn't it? And it, like last week, it doesn't really drag. I mean, possibly, okay, towards the end, but for majority of it, it does just, you know, go for, it just, you know, it's easy watching.
Oh, definitely.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't, none of it drags. I mean, even though it just kind of fall down the last 20 minutes or so, it doesn't kind of drag. I'm never bored.
So, you know, at least there's always that. And I think sometimes...
There is, but it still occurs to me from tomorrow night, I start prepping Dying of the Day.
Oh, dear.
The thing is, so, I'm actually quite enjoying that.
It's one of those ones that's good to watch if you're drunk, so...
Yeah, but okay, you need serious alcohol and liver problem to like that film.
Yeah, it's good fun. I like to spot all the references to past movies. That's what keeps me going through that film.
I can't wait for the fun facts for that one.
Yes, so I've got some very fun facts coming your way about that one. Don't you worry about that.
Fun facts, people.
You can look up yourself on Wikipedia.
I'm looking forward to rewatching Dying of a Day. Maybe more for not the right reasons, but yeah, I'm not as people probably guess, I'm not as down on Dying of the Day as most hardened Bond fans. I think it does get, well, yeah, rightly so, it does get a bad rap, but, it's kind of like Moonraker, as far as I'm concerned. It's kind of like that.
You said on Twitter the other day that you said it was too silly, and, you can't be too down on it just because it's very fun and frothy and silly, and I think, I agree with you there.
Well, I think
ridiculous in extreme.
One night, I just like I started to watch it, and I just like, oh no, I'm just gonna watch this as a spoof, and it just worked a lot better.
Yeah.
Just like, okay.
When we're finished here, it's going straight into my DVD player. I am going to immerse myself in this film for the next few days.
Oh God, watch it 5 times.
Well, maybe, to be honest, because I'm gonna watch. Yeah, I'm gonna watch a lot of Die Another Day in the next.
Who are you?
I think you're gonna go mad, Dave. I think you're gonna end up like.
He's gonna go deep.
Christ! I mean, how many times did you have to watch? What was it? Moonraker.
Moonraker was 5 times.
Watched that 5 times.
I won't be that because I'm not counting commentaries there. I'm just counting watching the film.
What was the other one? Was it Diamonds?
I watched quite a lot of Diamonds, yeah, but that was including commentaries. I watched that 4 times, but that includes commentaries. Whereas with Moonraker, I watched the commentary, and it may even been a couple of them, but I watched the film, 5 times.
Wow.
Jeez, that's impressive.
That's a lot of Moonraker.
I know, and it's really gutting when you think, like, the end result was our Spy Who Loved Me episode's really good. And our For Your Eyes Only episode is excellent. And our Moonraker episode's all right. And you think, mm-hmm. Well, I watched it 5 times for the most average of that 3.
Yeah.
But there you go.
I think probably one of the reasons is you've watched it so many times, you're kind of like sick of...
Oh, I stopped paying attention.
Yeah, you're kind of like, oh, I'm just fucking... I don't even want to think about that film even right now, you know.
But so anyway, before tonight is out, I will be watching Die Another Day.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which means, by next week, I'll be ready to discuss the greatest movie of
2002.
Lee Tamahori that month.
Well, his greatest movie is Once Were Heroes, I think. That's still his greatest film. Well, yeah, Once Were Warriors, that was it. So great, I can't even get the title correct.
I've not seen that. But I have seen XXX 2.
State of the Union.
Oh, dear.
State of the Union.
I don't think I've seen any of XXX movies. I'm probably not missing out.
XXX 3 is in post-production right now.
God. There's no end to it.
Well, there is.
There will be eventually.
Well, yeah, because eventually the Earth, the sun will go become a red giant and we won't be able to support life on this planet.
Of course, so, there is that.
Too much. It'll all stop.
Thank you, I feel better now. So anyway, where can we be found on social media?
On that happy note,
Well, I can be found at the Pasty Kid 1976 on Twitter. What about you, Chris?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Cinematronics, spelt with an X at the end. And you can also find this podcast as well as my other podcast that I do on cinematronicsco.uk.
That's the sort of podcast I think would be perfect for a review of Batman v Superman.
It would be, and I believe you've guested on that particular episode.
I have.
Listen to it, folks. It's great.
Yeah. So, Becca, I'm coming for you next. Come on the podcast I do once a year for some time.
Yeah, we've got to do Captain America: Civil War.
That's going to be good. I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, shouldn't we cover that for the Marvel retrospective?
Yeah, it's awkward because it's things we're going to cover eventually.
Yeah, we'll get there.
My main thinking is, okay, so what happens when the next James Bond film gets made? Are we going to, like, stop the presses? We're doing Bond again, the show.
Yeah, we'll just do a Bond episode.
Yeah, do one episode to cover it.
Mm. Okay, well, anyway, so we know where we can find you, Becca.
Yeah, you can find me at RVMovies on Twitter. But you can find us across the social media sphere at Expected to Talk, facebook.com/expectedtotalk, or expectedtotalk@gmail.com. We've had a reply from Matt, which he suggests other film series that we might do.
Do you know what? When I saw his suggestion, I'm not going to say what all of it was, but he did suggest the Alien films. Well, that's handy because I own them. But also, when I look through music, I have been looking for an excuse to play Killer Queen by Queen. Well, that would work perfectly for Aliens.
Yes, definitely.
So we will bear it in mind, Matt.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, thanks for your email. Definitely.
Mm. Or would that include the Alien versus Predator as well?
Yeah, does
no. Oh. All right, well, then yes, because Becca says and she's in charge. Never say no to a lady.
And Prometheus.
But that means we'd have to do the Predator movies as well.
No, yep. Actually, no, Becca just said so, yes. Okay, if we do Alien, Becca's in charge of what we do, because frankly it would have been the four Alien films, Prometheus and the Prometheus sequel for me. But if Becca wants us to, like, cover, I don't know, Mac and Me or something, then fine. God,
I haven't seen that since it's released. Jeez. I shall think about it, and we shall let you know down the line.
Yeah, we've got another two franchises.
We've got Indy and Star Trek next. We know we're doing Star Wars and Superman next year. We don't know what else we're doing next year. We'll figure it out.
It's top secret, and then we'll release it near at the time.
It's so top secret, even we don't know.
We don't know.
What was suggesting? Just Alien series, or what else was
there? Yeah, he suggested Alien, Matt. Yeah.
And then all the Westerns.
All the Westerns.
He was talking about Westerns, but obviously we're going to cover every Western ever made, because Becca said.
Yeah.
Actually.
She's in charge.
We're not really
going to do all the Westerns, but maybe just like, we're going to pick a couple that stand out.
Well, to kind of get them in. Dollars so. Trilogy and Once Upon a Time in the West. That's what
Yeah, sounds about right. So. Despite my American studies degree, I'm not a massive fan of Westerns. I don't know why. But anyway, that's by the by.
I've tinted it for you, Becca.
You're not a massive fan of Westerns, but yeah, you suggested two
every Western ever made.
Well, I figure, you know, we've got to be very, we don't want to be exclusionist, we want to be inclusionist, you know, and that's a word. I don't want to leave any genre behind.
Big shout out to Bo while you're listening.
Hi, Boxer, we like that tweet. It's like me suggesting, like, I know, let's do all the Woody Allen films, because I'm not sure I dislike him enough. No, that's not true. I do.
Have you changed your opinion massively about him then?
No, I think he's just seen some merit.
I do think he's overrated as, particularly, I don't know, I think mainly it's Midnight in Paris. Because
yeah, definitely.
That is like people say, "Oh, it's wonderful, Woody Allen returns."
No, it's really not.
It's pretentious claptrap. You know, it's.
No, I kind of agree.
Yeah, well, there you are. At least we agree on something about Woody Allen. And Play Against Sam is actually generally pretty good.
I love Play Against Sam. It's really funny.
Yeah,
hilarious.
Yeah. So anyway, that's where we are. That's who we are. And also, we've got Star Trek coming. And do we want to announce we might have a guest for that series?
Charlie.
Yeah. Do you expect us to talk is the three of us, but we are going to have a permanently invited guest just for that series. Charlie Brigden will be on that series. The man has an Enterprise tattoo. We couldn't say no.
No, he's a Star Trek fan, and plus, obviously, he's a resident music expert. So, yeah, we're delighted to have him on for the whole of our Star Trek retrospective series. So, looking forward to it.
Hopefully, he'll turn up every week, but he'll turn up when he can.
And no, I'm looking forward to having him on the show.
Awesome. That'll be great.
He'll be the special guest that is, like...
The special guest for the whole series. We'll always have him on for music, but we're so looking to forward to having him on for that. Because he knows his Trek.
He does. He knows his stuff. So, resident Trek expert.
Which is good, because I know that's nothing about Star Trek.
That's all right. I will teach you.
I can tell you about the TV series, but for the films... but I'm delighted to going on this journey with both of you, with all of you, so...
I think we should watch The Wrath of Khan.
God!
We're going to watch all of them anyway, but I think we should watch The Wrath of Khan beforehand just to...
Yeah, definitely get you in the mood.
Right, good night, folks. I'm done. What about you, Chris?
Anyway, we shall return with the god-awful Die Another Day.
I'm gonna break up. Yes and no. They all die.
Better than Madonna, people. Better than Madonna.
Yeah, Chris has got nicer tits than Madonna as well.
I watched the video clip of Key Music to do their take on that, and you realise when they do it, there is little substance to that song. There really is. It's like
they are so much better than Madonna. Oh, Jesus,
of course. I mean, they don't sort of go Sigmund Freud, Sigmund Freud.
Analyze this.
As if like. Well,
no, seriously, I cannot plug Cue the Music enough. If you haven't heard of them, YouTube them, buy their albums.
Also, even if you don't watch Cue the Music, just know Warren Ringham has the prettiest, happiest baby ever.
Oh, bless her, she's so cute.
Every photo, she is the happiest baby.
She's the smiliest little baby.
Yeah. Good night, folks.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Good night.